Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. Now, on with our program.
This is Mike Consul. Thank you for joining us. In the spotlight is novelist Elena Dillon.
Hi, I'm Elena Dillon. I tend to write books about surprising events based on historical situations involving women who are fighting injustices. They usually have a feminist slant. I live on the North Shore of Boston in Beverly, Massachusetts, with my husband and two children and our black lab. And we enjoy exploring the area, which is, if you've never been here, is just picturesque New England with fishing coves and apple orchards, and I never want to leave here.
Do you spend any time in Marblehead, Massachusetts?
Yes, my brother lives in Marblehead, and yeah, we're only about 25 minutes away.
It's so beautiful there. So Elena, you are out with a new...
Yes, Eyes Turn Skyward.
Eyes Turn Skyward, and I wanted to read for people one of the... a quote from Leonardo da Vinci that you use as a little bit of a preamble to the book. It says, you quote him as saying, "Once you have tasted flight, you will forever walk the earth with your eyes turned skyward, for there you have been, and there you will always long to return." And again, that's Leonardo da Vinci. Talk a little bit about your new book in terms of what the inspiration was for it.
Yeah, so about 10 years ago, last month, actually, I was just kind of in need of a new subject. And I thought I would write a book about my aunt, who in the 50s, my great aunt, who in the 50s drove across country with her girlfriends from New York to California to become a nurse over there. And I thought that was so unusual for a group of women at the time. And so I started researching the 50s and just like general kind of exploration of the time period, because I'd never really written a historical piece before. And I found myself just kind of doing that Wikipedia loop where like you'll be, you know, researching a certain topic and then there'll be a link to something else and you're bouncing around. And ultimately I found myself then in the 40s with the women Air Force service pilots. And they were the first women to fly military aircrafts in this country. They were invited to do so during World War II because there was a call for men to go overseas, male pilots to go overseas. And so they needed women to fulfill the domestic flight duties. So a group of women went to Sweetwater, Texas, and learned how to fly every plane on the market. A lot of people didn't think it was possible. They didn't think that they thought women were too delicate to fly big bombers and too emotional to maneuver such powerful aircrafts. But they rose to the occasion and they proved everybody wrong. And there was kind of this implicit understanding that ultimately they would be folded into the military and granted the opportunity to pursue careers in flying, like their male counterparts in the male military. But once the war situation started to end and women and men were being sent home, the opposition was able to claim that women were no longer relieving men, but replacing them, and that that was a problem. And so they were disbanded after 2 years of service and made to pay their way home. And it struck me that how every woman across the nation who had entered the workforce in factories, assembly lines, must have felt very similarly to have like been invited in to be productive and to kind of exercise a different part of themselves that they hadn't been able to before, and then very suddenly sent back to where they had been without any other option. But particularly for these women Air Force service pilots who had conducted these dangerous missions and who had, you know, risen to such heights, literally, to then be returned to the kitchen, and how like that would have affected them for the rest of their lives and then affected the next generation as they raised daughters of their own. So that's kind of what inspired the book. It went through a lot of different iterations in which it was a complete historical piece, like a totally taking place in World War II. And then over the course of literally 10 years, and I know that because I had a Facebook memory remind me last month, it turned into this dual timeline piece in which we're traveling back and forth between the 40s and contemporary day when these WASP were given the Congressional Gold Medal in 2010, where we follow a storyline with a pilot's daughter who is trying to reconcile this contentious relationship that she had with her mother, which she didn't understand why until this invitation for the medal ceremony arrived.
So Eyes Turned Skyward is billed as a powerful examination of the cost, emotional, familial, generational, when women are denied the right to soar. And I'm quoting from Kate Quinn, New York Times bestselling writer, says Elena Dillon's poetic prose and complex characters will linger long after the last page is turned. Now, in addition to that novel, Elena has also written one called The Happiest Girl in the World and another one called Mercy House. So The Happiest Girl in the World is billed as a gripping new novel about a young woman's dreams of Olympic gymnastic gold and what it takes to reach the top. Mercy House, according to Amy Schumer, the Amy Schumer, I'm assuming, is a life-altering debut featuring fierce, funny, and irreverent women who battle the most powerful institution in the world, meaning the Catholic Church. This is the book we've all been waiting for, end quote. Talk a little bit about your feminist instincts. Where do they come from? Because a lot of women don't really give voice to that at all. Did you at certain points in your life find that you were told you couldn't do things, or were you being limited? Did you run into discrimination because of your gender? Where did it originate from?
So I think no more so than any other woman. But I think that it's programmed into all of us to kind of, place certain people in certain categories and to make assumptions and have expectations of those people just based on stereotypes. I wouldn't even have described myself as a feminist writer until recently when having to write the back summaries for all the books. And like, once you have to boil, 80,000 words down to 200 and to sum it all up, it kind of puts into perspective, sharp themes and character journeys and really what's the crux of every novel. And once I've had to do that, then I saw the commonalities, but I think they're, I never really considered myself a feminist only because there's such a stigma attached to it. And it's like, there's been this tendency to use that word as a bad word or the, as like,
what is the stigma as you see it? What is the stigma?
So I would say that, historically we've thought of feminists as angry, harpies, people who want to take down men who are bitter and resentful. That's just like kind of how it's been branded. When truthfully, all it means is that you want equal status for men and women, like you just want basic human rights. And so that tends to be what all my books are about. I mean, even my memoir, My Body is a Big Fat Temple, has been just kind of exploring the ways in which women have been discriminated against due to like medical issues and with pregnancy and postpartum and how like we're struggling to get basic care and to be supported by the larger system. So I tend to be inspired by kind of like these untold stories or stories that I want to investigate and understand better. And with Mercy House, it was the investigation of nuns that took place during the apostolic visitation in 2010, when the Vatican was under the assumption that nuns were being too feminist themselves and too secular and fighting for human rights rather than kind of pushing forward the Catholic agenda. And so in writing that story, it became a woman's story. And then I was captured by like the Larry Nassar scandal and all of the ramifications of that institution of the USA Gymnastics and how it, you know, harbored such a threat to these girls and you know, were kind of after glory more than supporting them as individuals and protecting them as they should have been. So of course that was a female story. And then with these women Air Force service pilots, which was actually a book that I had begun even before The Happiest Girl and Mercy House. So I think just like in uncovering these injustices and wanting to put characters to it to kind of show why these situations are important and what's at stake, it ends up being a feminist book simply because it's women facing problems.
So My Body is a Big Fat Temple. Love the title. As you mentioned, it's the memoir that you wrote. It's a memoir of pregnancy and early motherhood that follows a writer as she debates having children, miscarries, faces morning sickness, uncertainty, physical impairments, labor, breastfeeding, and the baby blues, the heartache of not loving her son as she thinks she should, parenting through a plague until finally, and it says basically mostly, blossoming into her new identity. Now, this was your experience, correct? It's a memoir.
Yes.
You have one child or more than one? You have a
now
son?
Now I have two. I just had, I had my son was born in 2019 and I just gave birth in June to a daughter.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So you've got one of each gender, and are you planning a bigger family than that, or are you good with the two?
You know, I'd consider more if pregnancy wasn't just so damn hard. So no, I think we're done, but I guess never say never.
Yeah, it's amazing how some women just thrive in pregnancy; they glow. It's yes. That like a natural state for them, and other women they really struggle with it. Obviously, you know it definitely takes a toll on your body. Did you have the baby blues the second time? You had postpartum depression after your daughter was born as well, or
you know,
were you past that?
I had even worse nausea with her. Like the pregnancy was much more difficult, and I thought that the first one was difficult as it was. But then no, I didn't have postpartum depression the second time. It's like they're all like you said, some women. You know, are empowered by pregnancy and some women are debilitated by it. And I think it's even just different based on each circumstance. Each pregnancy can be very different.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go through the progression. Was the memoir your first book or what order did these books come in?
So Mercy House about the nuns was my debut. And then The Happiest Girl in the World came second. And then My Body's Big Fat Temple was third. And now Ice Turned Skyward.
And the Ice Turned Skyward took you how long to write and finish?
Well, like I said, I started researching 10 years ago. From beginning of the research to landing on the bookshelves was 10 years. And that's the longest one so far. So like it's not become very systematic for me. I like haven't really learned how to do an efficient writing process yet. I don't know if that's out there. But it's very variable. For Mercy House, it was 5 years from beginning to bookshelves. And then for Happiest Girl, it was shorter. It was 2 years. So it's like, yeah, I went from 5 to 10. Who knows what's next? I think it really depends on how quickly I zero in on what the story is. And sometimes it takes me a long time to figure that out.
Now, do you have ideas in mind for subsequent books when you're working on one, or are you just completely engrossed in what you're obviously you're completely engrossed in what you're doing? That's just the writing process. But do you also have some other ideas on deck, or do you not even deal with that until you've finished the current project?
Because things haven't been like very smooth where it's like, okay, I write a book and then I give it to my agent and she gives it to my editor and it's accepted and published. I end up rotating between projects like every few months. So like I'll finish something and I'll give it to my agent and then she'll be like, I'm not sure I can sell this. And so I'll put it aside and I'll start something else. And then she'll give it to my editor and my editor will be like, oh no, I'm not sure I can sell this. And so then I start something else. And then like, I realize then maybe how to make the first one better. And so I'll return to the first one. And then, you know, it just becomes this kind of this rotating, process until I bring a project to as far as I can go. I can bring it at the moment, and either it gets through the gates or it has to go back and sit until I figure out a different way And so I rely really heavily on readers for that. And you know, like The Happiest Girl in the World was the fastest. That was just like, give it to my agent back and forth until we together brought it to a place where my editor liked it. And then otherwise, I've had to put things aside a lot. And then, you know, I could be working then on three different books in 1 year, but only one at a time. So I'll work on one for like 4 months until I get it as strong as I can be at the moment. And then if I hear that it's not ready still, I'll put it aside and work on another one for like 4 months until I bring it as far as I can get for the moment. And it works like that. It's kind of messy.
Yeah. Well, that's the process so often. So if somebody was to say you're a feminist author or feminist novelist, is that accurate, or would you say that's an overstatement?
I would say that's accurate.
Okay.
Yeah, at least
so what is that? What does that do for your, in terms of your audience then? So your audience, I don't know how much any author knows about their demographics in terms of, probably the easiest part of it is, you know, the number, maybe a ratio between male and female readers. And women tend to read more than men anyway, certainly more fiction than men. So do you have any sense of your audience in terms of any kind of demographic information?
Yeah, I mean, after I, you know, after I write a book, there is like a discussion with my editor and agent, and then with the sales team about who is the target audience for this. And although like probably all authors hate to limit it, like that is kind of a consideration for marketing purposes. So it is something that's important to consider. And so I usually, you know, bill it as women, and then market like kind of around the age of the main character, or have that be like a guideline anyway, or some kind of factor. And although I think that's limiting, and there are certainly outliers, generally I think people kind of base the readership on who the character is, which is probably as like beneficial as it is a consequence, because like we really should be reading outside of our experiences. That's kind of what the magic of story is that it expands our worldview, but it won't do that if we assume that the reader is just aligned with the main character already. That's just kind of like living inside an echo chamber. And I think when it comes to like male characters, we tend to give more, you know, leeway that we assume that women will be watching or reading regardless. But when it comes to the flip side of like female television shows or female you know, leads in movies or books, then we create separate categories where we call them rom-coms or women's fiction or chick lit, which is just another way of really saying that it's about women. And I think I hope that's changing, especially, I think it starts in Hollywood first, where like they're coming out with like really solid shows that are created by women and starring women that are really meant for everybody. And so I think that, I hope that trickles down to other mediums of story. And I do occasionally hear from men who have read Mercy House seems to get the most traction. And so that's always heartening. I've heard from a couple men who read my pregnancy memoir, which I thought was awesome, because, you know, part of the real struggles with pregnancy and postpartum periods is that like, we just don't talk about it at all. And so it's not really respected by the medical community or taken seriously by like the larger public. Mm-hmm. And so if men are reading those stories and kind of understanding and seeing more experiences, I think that it will get more attention and respect in general. But yeah, I think it's clear that my main readership is female. But I hope that changes, and I hope that it, like people that men in general aren't just like scared off by, you know, female led books.
Right. What kind of an attitude do you bring to the keyboard when you're writing? Yeah, I ask that question because, you know, you write about athletes such as gymnasts or a pilot, and anytime, for instance, a gymnastics competition, there's always mental preparation. There's always really having to get revved up and get into a certain state of mind. I'm not sure writers think in terms of their daily activity at the keyboard as something that needs to be prepped for. Do you have any kind of attitude you bring to the keyboard, or do any kind of prep you do before you sit down and actually start hammering away?
My time is so limited. I don't think there's room for prep. I sit down with a cup of coffee and I try to just like get into the mindset of whoever the character is. I think there's probably a lot of overlap between like, between actor exercises and writer exercises. You know, they talk about different acting, strategies and methodologies. And I think I probably, you know, do something similar where I try to get into the head of that character and understand, like, you know, not just their backstory, but like what they would be feeling, where like what their movements are like, what they physically look like, you know, their habits, just to try to like embody them in that moment, so that I can feel, you know, that pressure on the gymnastics floor or what it's like to climb into a cockpit. And I lean very heavily on research, where I hear firsthand from people who have been in that situation what it's like. So I read a lot of memoirs, I watch interviews, I basically inhale everything that I can on the subject, and work a lot off of that. And then, yeah, otherwise I just try to do my best to imagine.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Now, what is the hardest part of the book for you? Is it the beginning, the middle, or the end? You know, at the beginning, we always try to get off to a great start. You always have to, you know, be conscious of the slump in the middle that a lot of books suffer from. And the other thing a lot of books I see suffering from is that they rush to the ending. It's kind of like you get to a certain point. It's kind of like, I got to wrap this thing up. And there seems to be a little bit of a race to the finish. So each part of the book has got its own challenge. Is there a part of the book that really spans your titles that you would say, this is the part of the book that's the hardest for me?
So I'm trying to think about each title individually. So Mercy House, the opening scene was probably the only thing that went untouched. It was a story that I had heard, cause I used to work with nuns, and it was a story that I heard, about a coworker, that just felt so poignant and true and probably was the launching point to the book. And so that stayed true that entire time. And then the middle and the end for that one probably got the most attention. That was what like my agent and editor each individually, gave me some like different ideas of how to develop them, because they both kind of slumped. So together we like collaborated a way to keep the momentum up in those spots. And then the Happiest Girl in the World, I started writing, when I was pregnant and then like through my first year of having a newborn. And in the revision process, I think I found that after I gave birth, the writing really got shaky, and that was in the middle. So like I had to go back and bolster that a lot, but I think that's just because I was sleep deprived and all whacked out from hormones and stuff. So that might've just been its own individual case. And then Eyes Turn Skyward just got chopped to bits because it was a full length World War II book that I then cut down to half a book and weaved in a new timeline. So it's hard to say.
Wow. That was. That's quite an exercise there.
Yeah. And then what I'm working on now, I think I'm finding that I keep cutting off the beginning and starting later and later as I kind of zero in on what the story is. And I realize that the story really begins later and I need to develop that more. So I think with each case, it's individual based on like what the circumstances are in my personal life and like where I entered the story and how it came to me in one piece or not. Like, so I really find that it takes me a lot of drafts to figure out who the characters are and what they want. And with this research stuff, sometimes I write, especially when I'm writing contemporary things, sometimes it takes me so long that like the movement has changed. Like I'm toying with this opioid book and I started writing it 7 years ago, and like the opioid crisis has evolved and like our approach to it has evolved. And so I have to keep kind of altering the arc of the character to stay true to kind of what's current. So yeah, it all really depends.
So what are you working on now?
Yeah, So I'm currently working on this opioid book that it's one of those books that I keep setting aside and bringing back to the forefront, hoping that I find something that works here. I'm hoping this one is the ticket. I don't know.
So it's in development. It's in development.
In development.
You're not sure that you're going to see this one through to the end. You're
right.
Figuring out whether or not this one has some real traction.
Yes.
And I get it. So you write about real, one of the things I hear you saying, Elena, is your writing, your fiction is based on real events, the opioid crisis, what goes on in gymnastics, the female pilots during the war. You root your fiction in nonfiction, so to speak. Is that intentional? Is it just where your interests take you? Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is intentional. So I used to say that it was because I don't have an imagination, and people have been telling me that that's not true and to stop saying it. But I think it's like writing is so hard that I think I have to pick these subjects that really matter and that I find essential and want to surface in order to like keep committed to it. It's these topics that I find like that I can't turn away from, that are the only things that really would get me the stamina to continue.
Interesting. So why the opioid crisis? Did you have any personal, did you know people who got tangled in that?
I mean, I to some extent, but I started it because we moved to this area of the North Shore of Boston. And it was just so beautiful here that I was like, I really want to write a book here so I can just kind of like live in this world, even on the page. And I was like, this is the first book that I started in setting as like the inspiration. So then I was like, all right, if this is the setting, like what conflicts here can I explore? And this is kind of like an opioid center of the country, especially because a local police department was one of the first to start an amnesty drug program in which substance users could walk in with drugs on their person and just be kind of funneled into rehab without any penalty.
Was that on 60 Minutes? Do they do
probably? Yeah, it got a lot of coverage.
Yeah, I think I saw that on 60 Minutes. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, that's it.
Okay.
Yes, that's what I'm developing.
Talk a little bit about, a lot of writers think about the writer's voice. What is my voice? And there are writers who spend an awful lot of their life trying to really find their voice. Do you consider yourself to have a voice? And if so, describe it. What would you say your writer's voice is?
Well, I'd like to think that the writers, that the voice is kind of distinct to the material and to the book. But I would imagine that there's a lot of overlap and that there's like, that it's probably very similar to my voice, but maybe like a little bit elevated and then slightly tipped toward the character. So I tend to write in third person limited, focused on the character. And so like, I'll have like a generic narrative voice that then is licked with personality, from the main characters who usually have like some wry sense of humor or, they're a little gritty. But a lot of my books also have a first person perspective, at least. So Mercy House has a rotating point of view from the residents that are in the Nuns Women's Shelter. And The Happiest Girl in the World has first person point of view from the gymnast's mother. And then I Stern Skyward is just third person, but flipping between the pilot and her daughter later. So I really like entering the first person voice because then it's just a fun change of pace for me as a writer, but it also really forces me to get to know the character even better and for the reader to quickly align themselves with the character and to, get some insight that maybe they wouldn't be afforded from a third person point of view. But with Eyes Turned Skyward, it was the first time that I wrote in a historical point of view. So that was also a fun challenge because all of the pilot's narration, even though it was in third person, also had to have kind of like a, you know, a historical twinge to it, which was like its own kind of dialect that I hadn't tried out before. So I think there's probably a lot of commonality between the voices, but I try to cater it also to the work.
Yeah, because depending on the story, a voice would need to change if it's going to sound authentic. So what about, I'm curious whether there was a turning point in your writing life. Was there a time when you learned or experienced something that made a difference for you, that made you feel that maybe you had found your channel, or maybe even a point where you decided, you know, you weren't even sure you had the chops to be a writer. And then it was like, you know, this is what I should be doing. This is what I was meant to do.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of moments where I didn't think I had the chops. So I started writing very seriously in my early 20s. I mean, I always wrote, but like I started pursuing it as like my life's vocation when I entered grad school at like 22, getting an MFA.
And then where were you in grad school?
Fairfield University. They have a low residency MFA program. So I was able to like, work and then, you know, do that as well. And then when I graduated at 24, I like just committed myself to writing. But it wasn't until, you know, so I was 32, I guess. Mercy House came out in, two years ago. Oh, yeah. Almost 3 years ago. So I was 33, I guess, when my debut came out. So that was 10 solid years of, you know, schooling and then, you know, just juggling part-time jobs after graduating while also writing. And I wrote many manuscripts, first in nonfiction, because that's what I originally was writing, and then trying my hands at novels. I wrote two novels before I started Eyes Turned Skyward, which will never see the light of day. And then I wrote Eyes Turned Skyward in the form that it was in, and then Mercy House, and then The Happiest Girl in the World, and then this opioid book I started as well, all before I sold Mercy House. So what
inspired the turn to fiction? You were writing nonfiction, you turned to fiction. Were you looking for more freedom? Were you looking for...
Honestly, like I was just having a hard time breaking into the nonfiction market. And, you know, I kept hearing like, you know, build a platform. And naively at the time, I was like, well, maybe I'll just like write a novel and then build my platform there. And then once I have, you know, followers, I could just switch back to nonfiction. And I never had any training in fiction writing. I mean, there's a lot of overlap between nonfiction and fiction, but I just started on my own writing a novel. Little did I know it was going to take 10 years to get it published and build a quote unquote platform. But once I started with fiction, I loved it. And
you fused the two together. I mean, you the overlap, you created even more overlap by you kind of fused the two together because your fiction is rooted in nonfiction.
Right. That's true. Yeah. So maybe that explains a lot of the root of why I choose to do it on real subjects. It's almost like journalistic, but then using that as a launching point for story. So the turning point for me really would have been when I signed with my agent, her name's Nikki Richeson, with Mercy House in 2018, of May 2018. So then I was 30. So I had been writing, you know, for 6 or 7 years, all sorts of different manuscripts. I had two previous agents, just getting a lot of rejections, constantly wondering if this was ever going to happen. And then I signed with her in May, and we had a publishing deal and Hollywood interest by August. So that was to go from like 7 or 8 years of writing rejections, not knowing what's happening, to like my life completely changing in 2 months, was the real turning point.
Wow. So talk about why you write. We all write because we get something out of that process, because there's a lot of time that's devoted to it. So why do you write?
I think it's like the only thing in my life. I shouldn't say it's the only thing. It's something vital to me that provides satisfaction that I haven't found in other work. So there's a lot of things that I like to do. I like to run. I like to be with my kids. I like to get bakery treats and eat them on a beach, like, you know, looking at the ocean. But like, I also need to write in order just to feel good, and to feel productive. There's been periods in my life where I've stopped writing for a few weeks or maybe a month and just was like, okay, maybe I'll just have a full-time career and something else. And I just get grumpy. And, my husband's like, you need to start writing again. So it's just vital. It's a practice like any other that just makes me feel good. And, it's cathartic and, you know, just makes me feel like I'm doing something worthwhile.
Yeah. The reason I kind of chuckled at that is because I say that to my wife, if I'm in a bad mood, you need to say to me, have you been writing or not?
Yeah.
Because if I'm not writing, it aggravates me that I haven't been writing, and I feel better when I am writing, even as frustrating as it can, any given writing day can be.
Yeah. The only thing worse than
put you in a bad mood too.
Right. The only thing worse than writing is not writing.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. That sums it up right there. So you get your MFA and you're writing, you're doing a part-time job. You're not married at that point, right?
So I got married. Yeah. Around this, actually, I think the same month that I graduated from my MFA, I got married. So it was all kind of, in tandem. So
you have a husband, but you didn't have children. Now you have children. Children are very time consuming, and that's a huge responsibility. Does that actually feed your writing in terms of, well, I guess what I'm getting at here, Elaine, is the productivity part of it. You don't have a lot of time. You've already basically said, you know, what little time I've got, I just dive into the writing when I get my opportunities. So do you find that you're as productive before having children as you are with children? Because sometimes people, these kinds of responsibilities create structure that actually facilitates the writing.
Yeah. So no, I'm definitely not as productive as I used to be. I get 3 hours a day to write, which is, I'm not complaining. It's, you know, a good amount. But I used to have these long, languorous days where I can drift in and out of rooms, and, you know, it's all I had to do. I could like take a break and watch a TV show and then go back. And, but so no, it's not like that anymore. I'm really fortunate that my husband has a flexible job schedule where he makes his work from, you know, 11 on, and I get the mornings and he watches the kids. But, you know, the kids are in the house, they're in and out of my bedroom. Like, it's not, you know, it certainly keeps me on task because I know that it could be interrupted at any moment, but, it's limited. And there are benefits as well, because, you know, I've formed this new identity and I have this new experience and this new love, and I've learned things, and, I'm able to now relate to characters, you know, who I have, who are parents, in a way that I wouldn't have been able to before. So yeah, it's different. But it is what it is. And it's a short amount of time, you know, like as soon as my son's already 4, and, you know, in a year or two, he'll be in school and I'll get those languorous days back. And I'm sure I'll be, you know, wishing that there are people pounding on my door, interrupting my work.
Well, you know, 3 hours a day is a good chunk of time for most people. You obviously, when you got started, you were doing more than that. Because you consider 3 to be a bit limited, but there are people who don't even find 3 hours in the day.
Yeah, no, it's a gift for sure.
So describe a good day of writing. What does a good day, how do you measure a good day of writing? I'm sure there's days when your husband sees you with a hop in your step and thinks things went well today. What goes what's a good day of writing look or sound like?
Yeah. So if I'm writing just like fresh material, if I'm sitting down to a blank page and just writing, I usually won't stop myself until I get 1,000 words. That's kind of like my benchmark. A good day would be 1,500. I'd feel like pretty good about that. And a bad day, like, I don't want to say a bad day, but like a more unsatisfying day is when I'm like reading through and just, you know, making little tweaks here and there, because it doesn't look as productive. It doesn't, like, it's harder to measure that work. So I like being able to highlight everything that I've done that day and see the word count.
Can you identify a book that's been the most influential in your life? Something?
Sure.
That,
yeah.
Yeah. What would it be?
So Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Strout is probably one of my favorites. I teach that book in my creative writing classes, so I've read it many times.
I'm not familiar with it. Can you give us a little description?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So it's really a collection of short stories, that build into a novel. But it's largely about this woman, Olive, and it follows her from her middle age into her old age. She lives on a coast, the coast of Maine, in a sea town. And she's this turbulent, grumpy woman, who is angry for a lot of different reasons. And it looks like at her relationship between her son and her husband. But then it kind of also rotates through all of these people in town and how they have brushed up against her and the ways in which her life has enriched them or burdened them. And it's just kind of like a look at this town. What drew me to it though, is that I had for so long heard about my characters when submitting to editors that they're unlikable. And I worked a lot on, drawing out all the likable qualities in my characters and trying to find that balance between, realism and humanity, and being realistic because everyone has flaws, but also presenting these, kind of heroines that people want to get on board with. But what drew me to Olive is that there really is very little on the surface to make her likable. And yet the author manages to engross you and to have you kind of, if not sympathize with her, at least empathize with her or kind of understand how she came to be so prickly and, still wanting her to grow, but in ways that are realistic. And she does evolve. That's Olive Kittredge.
Now you teach creative writing classes, you said. So how do you teach creative writing? How does somebody become more creative with their writing? What are some of the techniques that you use in the classroom?
So they're beginner students. So I just kind of break down all the literary elements, we'll do a lesson on characters and setting and plot and language and dialogue and just do like a regular, lesson and then apply it to a reading and then a published reading and then, do workshops. And I find that workshops are probably the most beneficial to understanding and developing craft, because not only do you get to see your own work discussed and getting feedback from people and seeing, what works and what doesn't, but you get to like read, your classmates and apply the lessons that we have, discussed and that we saw in published works to works in progress.
Well, what is the biggest strength of your game? You just broke down, dialogue, characters, maybe pacing, storyline and whatnot. What would you, is there a particular area that you feel is your strongest?
Probably dialogue. I really like, if I'm in a scene, like a good scene, like I'll often start with the dialogue and just write back and forth what the characters are saying to each other without worrying about, the tissue connecting them. Because that really what propels the scene for me. And that's what's most fun, like finding the voice in that dialogue and trying to be like, providing subtext and not being as direct as, is the tendency and being surprising. So that's probably the first. And then maybe the second is metaphor. And I like often have to hold myself back from overdoing the metaphors because that tends to be like my go-to figurative language for exposition. So I have to, in revision, I'm often just paring back some of the weaker metaphors so that the stronger ones stand alone without being diluted by, repetitive devices.
So who's your trusted reader? Who do you go to with something you've written that you think is ready for prime time? Is it your agent? Is it your husband? Are you part of any kind of writer's group?
So I'm always looking for new readers because it's such a huge ask to have somebody read and give you like valuable feedback. And I'm not above paying I'm not above paying people for it because it is a real service. But my probably most valuable reader is my husband. He's a math professor, so he's not you're the most obvious choice, but over all of the books that I've written, and I've been in a lot of places where I'm like, I need a reader. I need somebody to give me some feedback. I don't know where to go from here. And in my time of need, he has stepped in and be like, well, I could probably read it and give it like, you know, give you a response that isn't literary. And it started that way. But over the course of our relationship and all the books that I've written, he really has developed a keen editorial eye. And so he's like one of my closest, most careful, most thoughtful readers. And those are just like qualities that are built into him naturally. So he just applies that to this work as well. But yes, and I don't even have to pay him.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. What are you reading now? Do you read while you write? I obviously do research. You talk about that, but do you also indulge in a book at the same time that you're working on your own?
So I lean really heavily on audiobooks because I don't have the time that I would like to sit down with a book. So I do a lot of my quote unquote reading when I'm running or showering or doing the dishes or whatever. So I tend to try to find novels or nonfiction that are somehow related to whatever I'm working on. So I feel like they're, you know, kind of speaking to my current projects or giving, you know, shining new light on themes or characters. So currently, because I'm working on that opioid manuscript, I'm doing a lot of either memoirs from substance abusers or nonfiction from journalists. So currently I'm listening to the book Undoing Drugs, which is like a journalistic approach from a person who did use substances, but is also a journalist, about harm reduction as opposed to like punitive drug enforcement.
Why don't you read a little bit from Eyes Turn Skyward?
All right. So this is the first flashback of the pilot. Her name is Peggy, and it takes place when she's about to leave to go to Sweetwater to start the program. Peggy was 8 years old when her daddy lifted her by the armpits and dropped her into a cockpit. The instructor said, "A plane is no place for a little girl, that you'd be too scared." And I told him, "Not my Peg. Are you making a liar out of me?" her daddy asked. She didn't know how to tell him that she wasn't scared. She was grateful. So she just shook her head and brushed tears from her face. They left the ground, Peggy on her father's lap and the instructor in the bucket behind them. And she was gifted something she didn't know that she desperately desired. The boys at school didn't let her play Red Rover, insisting she join the girls in hopscotch. And she burned the Lazy Daisy cake in home economics. Her father promised that her feeling of restlessness was because she was special, but she'd been starting to think it was just loneliness and that she was destined to be unhappy. But now here was the wind stealing her breath. Her feet were off the ground and her head was in the clouds. The whole thing was a miracle. Her father had handed her a discovery, a potential to go anywhere, to be anything. She could fly, for God's sakes. By the time Peggy was in high school, she managed the Model A better than her father, but his crop dusting clients wouldn't abide a young woman spraying chemicals on their livelihood. She was a feisty little thing, to be sure, but they weren't willing to hand over their farm to a girl, no matter how pretty. Her value began and ended with what they saw before them. Thin eyebrows arced over eyes the shape of a setting sun, cheekbones high enough to create a cavity beneath their ridges, lips that could turn from sweet to cruel, and thick auburn hair that she, with her daddy's permission, tucked into her cap when she did his crop dusting from then on. Peggy had watched with interest this last year as her former classmates packed their suitcases and left for positions in defense industries. It was unprecedented, women doing the work of men. She was tempted to join the tide, imagining the power of a riveting gun inside her grip, assembling a plane bolt by bolt and releasing it into the sky. It would be something to be surrounded by planes, but it would mean leaving her Model A behind and staying grounded. That just wasn't her brand of adventure. Then came the call. Male pilots were needed overseas, so for the first time in history, women were being trained to perform domestic flight duties on military aircraft. Peggy had to be one of those pioneer fly girls. If not her, a misfit in all other spheres whose body chemistry only properly calibrated at 1,000 feet, Then who? This meant traveling 700 miles to Sweetwater, Texas. She loved her parents, particularly her daddy, but not more than she loved the idea of herself as a woman Air Force service pilot. There was so much evil, and with her special skills, she could do some good. More importantly, she could be seen as someone who could do some good. The possibility made her electric. She might just combust as lightning. Her desire wouldn't be enough in itself, no matter its unwieldy size. Only 8% of applicants were being accepted. She fit the age, education, and flight qualifications, but she still had to pass an Army physical and a written exam and be personally interviewed by Jackie Cochran. Although Peggy had scarfed down more than her share of fried spam and victory cake in preparation, she was still 2 pounds below the weight requirement. She could fail the physical. There was a swirling inside her at that thought, where excitement eddied against nerves. She'd be damned if she missed the opportunity by the heft of a bag of flour. Peggy was soaring 500 feet in the air. Who knew when she'd be back in this plane, in this sky, overlooking this town? She took in the neighbor's farm scattered with cows, bored by another muggy day, a sunflower field that carpeted all the way to the horizon, and the general store, gas station, and post office that made up Main Street. The people here, who always looked at her askance as that bony gal with the pretty face and wind-whipped hair, who would never find a husband, would either in a week's time eye her like they'd been right all along, or she'd prove what she'd known from her very first flight, that she was destined for a higher purpose. Peggy rocked the aircraft, wagging her wings.
Very nice. So that's from Eyes Turn Skyward, which was released. How long has it been out now, Elena?
October 18th it was released.
Okay, so it's new, it's fresh. And listeners, you can get yourself a copy. Elena, thank you for taking the time and coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.